Welcome to The Reason Rundown, the podcast to end your week. One Reason journalist, one big story, once a week. I'm Peter Suderman. Once upon a time, the Golden State was the land of golden opportunity. In post-war America, California was sunny and sprawling with a booming economy, plentiful employment, and comfortable middle-class neighborhoods. It was a great place to work, own a home, and raise a family. California was the American dream.
Wherever you look in this California playland, you'll find outdoor living at all seasons.
The home they've always dreamed of, the happiest investment they have ever made. At last, the Bryants have all the space they need. Big floor-to-ceiling closets for each member of the family. Large, comfortable bedrooms.
But over time, something changed. California was never exactly a cheap place to live, but more and more, it became prohibitively expensive, especially in and around San Francisco, the epicenter of America's booming tech industry. As recently as the late 1990s, the median home price in the San Francisco Bay Area, adjusted for inflation, was just over $500,000. Today, it's more like $1.5 million. And that's in a state where median income is around $78,000 a year. Ordinary families have been priced out.
But the price of homes went sky high so quick, pretty much priced us out of the market for what we wanted to get.
But it was the biggest cities that were the hardest hit. And that was also true here in Southern California.
Meanwhile, urban governance has increasingly proven unwilling or unable to respond to the problems of the moment. If high prices and high taxes didn't drive families away, homelessness, crime, disorder, and failing schools did. San Francisco has already seen a voter backlash in the form of recalls of the city's progressive DA, as well as several outspoken progressive members of the city school board.
San Francisco can now move forward with new leadership that will chart a better and safer path for our city.
Some residents, however, are voting with their feet. California lost residents in both 2020 and 2021, and many are leaving for places like Austin, Texas, and Miami, Florida, both of which have cultivated reputations as up-and-coming tech hubs with cheaper housing, lower taxes, and better governance.
A year ago, I moved from San Diego, California to Miami, Florida, sight unseen.
So, come one, come all to the great state of Texas. But before you do, let's get one thing straight. This is not an invitation to simply transfer the f***ery of California to Texas. We Texans are very inviting to people from California, but that doesn't mean we want you to California our Texas.
But have these cities really improved on San Francisco's model, or are they doomed to repeat San Francisco's mistakes?
Right, and we're creating those high-paying jobs.
Suarez has been actively recruiting tech companies who've brought thousands of high-paying jobs to the area. But the majority of those jobs have gone to out-of-towners moving to South Florida.
That's the question posed by Reason Associate Editor Liz Wolf in her recent feature article, California's Competitors, which looks at the political and economic fortunes of both Austin and Miami and the reasons these southern pastures might not be greener.
Well, my hope is that by everybody chilling out, people can focus on what we can do to make it better. Instead of getting so lost in the challenges that we face that they can't be constructive.
That was Austin Mayor Steve Adler commenting on the zoning debate. Now, Liz, you have lived in Austin off and on for many years, right? So you have seen the influx of Californians, especially from San Francisco. Why would someone from California want to move there in the first place?
I mean, there are so many reasons why Austin is an attractive, promised land for San Francisco's migrants. If you look at it, it's a city that has a lower starting point for housing and land prices. I think people really have a sense that they can get places that are more affordable, the types of places that they want to live in, while still being plugged into a pretty significant tech and entrepreneurship-oriented community here. I mean, Texas is also a state with no income tax, so a lot of these really high earners are able to keep a much higher chunk of their profits, which matters a lot. If you're making $400,000, $500,000 a year or more, being able to have more of your income that you keep to yourself is really great. I think for a long time, like you said, the post-war California dream was a really great one. It was a time of sprawl and abundance. It gave us, movie theaters, bowling alleys, amusement parks, abundant housing, a bunch of fast food chains that have endured through the ages.
Surfing.
It gave us surfing. It gave us Joan Didion. It gave us Matt Welch. What's not to love?
I mean, in addition to tech, it was obviously a cultural hub and remains so.
Yeah, and few people dispute that California is a really objectively delightful place to spend time. I actually ironically wrote this feature having absconded to LA for an entire month from Austin. My family on my mom's side is all California military folk. I do think a lot of people feel like the dream has really withered and died, and they're upset about it. I don't think they're crazy or wrong. So my intention when I set out to write this piece was to really take their concerns super seriously. I was really fascinated by the seemingly pervasive sentiment among this very tony, high-earning tech crowd that city officials had taken them for granted and really considered them cash cows for way too long and failed to deliver all the necessary services that make these cities livable. Nobody wants to be taken for granted, and nobody wants to be used to fill up city coffers with very little received in return. I also think one of the components to all of this is that Silicon Valley dudes have an almost technocratic libertarian sensibility to them, but it's coupled in a weird way with an almost socially conservative appreciation for public order. And it's really hard to tell whether these attitudes cropped up by nature of them living in San Francisco and seeing its dysfunction, or whether that mindset was really pervasive prior to these experiences.
Tell me a little bit more about this idea that San Francisco took its tech industry workers, its high earners and entrepreneurs for granted. Why do people feel like that? And what do you think San Francisco has done to earn that reputation?
Yeah, one of the basic things that we can always point to is the incredibly high rates of taxation, both from the state and from the city. But I also think there's a reason that people like Michael Schellenberger have risen in prominence. Schellenberger is kind of an interesting dude. He ran for governor and lost recently, somewhat predictably, and his entire campaign was really predicated on quality of life issues. So he had a lot of strategies for dealing with crime and homelessness and public disorder, despite the fact that this guy came from like a nuclear energy background. But it was clear that this is something that's really salient to a lot of San Francisco voters. If you actually drill into the statistics, California is a huge national outlier in terms of what proportion of the homeless population is actively unsheltered. So that means sleeping on the streets or under highway overpasses. In San Francisco, 73% of the city's homeless population is unsheltered. For comparison, in New York City, where I spend a lot of my time, the figure is about 3%. So it's not just a matter of the homeless population being larger in San Francisco compared to other cities. It's also that they're extremely visible. And so I think that feels threatening for many people. Like it lends itself to, whether this is correct or not, more a sentiment, a perception of more likelihood of being attacked or harassed or inconvenienced. It possibly leads to public defecation and people being passed out on sidewalks. And I think the thing that people miss about this is it's not just that rich people don't like to see the homeless people. It's that this is a moral abomination and an indicator of a city or a neighborhood that's not doing well. I think it's much more complex than just, oh, you don't like to see homeless people nearby. I think for a lot of people, it seems like a symptom of a problem, which is that this community, this society that's taking an awful lot of rich people's money either hasn't prioritized or is misspending the money to attempt to alleviate some of these really terrible, obvious examples of blight and human suffering. I also think we have to pay attention to the fact that, like, the other thing that cities are supposed to do well, schools, is not something that San Francisco has done well at all. They've actually really beclowned themselves quite impressively. Schools stayed shut in the area for extra long until fall of 2021. But I know you know about this, Peter, and we've had a whole bunch of people like Matt Welch and Robbie Suave cover this at Reason. During the closure, school board officials decided to rename 44 problematically named schools. So these were schools named after people like George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Dianne Feinstein, which, like, okay, fair, she is a little problematic. But I mean, school closures affected 50,000 students in the area. And then these school board officials relied on all sorts of euphemisms like learning change instead of learning loss, which is actually what happened. They just failed to actually do their jobs. And so San Francisco voters eventually fired three school board members in a recall election in February. When you really drill down to the basics of what a city's supposed to provide, what is it more other than a safe place to live, basic sanitation, nice parks, good schools, a place where small businesses can flourish, where vermin and plagues don't overtake the city? I mean, San Francisco city officials just failed on every single count.
So I take your point, especially about schools and about some of the disorder. But I do wonder, I mean, many people who are sort of who are critics of tech industry, who are on the progressive side, hear these complaints and they basically say, look, this, these are just a bunch of rich people who are already separated from the community, who aren't actually willing to make a difference themselves. And they're basically, you know, if they're moving to Miami, if they're moving to Austin, what they're saying is, I'm just not going to take any responsibility at all. And they just want a city like San Francisco to be a playground for the upper middle class and the super wealthy. And I mean, how do you respond to that? What do you think of that line of criticism that this is just rich people griping about, you know, about things that don't even really affect them in a lot of ways?
I think it's really misplaced. I think it's a really dumb, weird line of criticism, in part because it assumes that cities aren't on the hook to provide good services to people. There's a sense of like, oh, well, you have to be really civically engaged in order to get the things that you spent your tax dollars on or that your tax dollars paid for. I mean, these people, their money is being taxed away and they're getting very, very little in return. So it's a question of voice and exit. And I think a lot of these people have exercised their voices and attempted to change things, attempted to use their prominence and their platforms to draw attention to a lot of these problems. But ultimately, exit is sort of the thing that a lot of them have gravitated toward. I would also note, though, that voice has played a pretty significant role in this because California, actually, to its credit, has a really strong tradition of being able to fire politicians. This is something Welch has covered a ton at Reason, and I think he's 100% right that it is really important for citizens of cities and states to have the ability to participate in recalls and to basically tell their elected officials frequently, hey, you're not doing a good enough job and we want to replace you. This isn't a position, this isn't power that you can take for granted. This is something where we're going to be delivering a referendum on your job performance. And so I would say that San Francisco residents have used that to great effect. We saw that with Chesa Boudin. We saw that with the fired school board members. But a bunch of them ultimately very much feel as though this was a place of innovation. This was a place where they were able to grow their companies 20 years ago, 30 years ago. I was just reading The Power Law and reviewing it for Reason Magazine. And it's a book all about the origins of venture capital and how the venture capital scene really developed, and especially what happened over the course of the 90s and sort of the tech entrepreneurs who shaped the internet as we consume it today. And, you know, without a lot of these people gravitating toward the Bay Area and it being this huge hub of talent, a lot of the things that we take for granted every day today, our ability to use social media sites, our ability to use Airbnb and Uber, our ability to get things delivered super quickly on Amazon Prime, had it not been for this hub of incredible action and investment and people putting their brains together, we would not have access to these things to nearly the same degree that we do today. So I think a lot of these people, although they're rich and seem disconnected now, they're people who feel like, wow, this was a right place, right time type situation that led to creative ferment that allowed us to not only profit, but to also deliver incredible resources to the rest of the world. And now that's no longer possible.
Yeah, I think progressives who are nominally, you know, supposed to be the ones who are out there in favor of big government and government provided services consistently underrate the notion that poor city services, poor urban governance actually ends up hurting poor people the most because people who have fewer resources can't necessarily move. They can't necessarily put their kids in private schools. They are, in many ways, the primary consumers of city services. And so when these cities are run badly, it may be the rich people who are most outspoken, but it's the poor who are affected by it the most. So I want to move on, actually just sort of shift a little bit and talk about Austin and Miami, because they are the subjects of your piece. We've heard a lot over the last 5 years, I think, in particular, but really over the last decade or two, about Austin and Miami as these business-friendly, comparatively inexpensive places to live, you know, low taxes. But a big part of your argument in the piece is sort of the opposite, that in a lot of ways they are repeating or at least on track to repeat San Francisco's mistakes. So tell me about that. Start with Austin, but also let me, you know, sort of talk us through how do you see Austin and Miami being on track to repeat the mistakes that San Francisco has made?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was interviewing Joe Wansteel, who's a venture capitalist, he was one of the early Palantir dudes. He started the VC firm 8VC. But he moved from San Francisco to Austin, and he's long on Austin now. He pointed to quite a few Austin perks. He pointed to the lower starting point of housing prices, the fact that there's not crazy shit like CEQA.
Tell us about what CEQA is.
Yeah, so he pointed this out really early in our conversation, which I thought was telling, because it's really awful, and anyone with the slightest bit of wonky housing policy knowledge will just go off about it, rightfully so. It was basically originally pitched in California as a way to protect the state's natural...
So it's an acronym?
Yeah,
we should, exactly. And we should just establish here, right? CEQA is the California Environmental Quality Act.
Mm-hmm. And it was initially pitched as a way to protect the state's natural preserves from state-backed building projects by requiring studies of environmental impact. So it sounds really well-intentioned. Eventually, though, it became a major legal blockade for private development. So it empowered all kinds of individuals, all kinds of interest groups. It empowered unions and environmental activists to demand really expensive, time-consuming environmental reviews, often with implicit demands for concessions from developers. So it was a way for a lot of these really politically motivated interest groups to basically hector and hassle developers and stymie development, stymie new building. So if you look at California, there's not only a lot of environmental constraints as to where people can build in the Bay Area, for example, given that it's surrounded by water, but there's also the use of CEQA. And it's really been absolutely awful. You can sort of look at California's incredibly high housing prices. I think the median San Francisco home goes for $1.5 million now. And you can really directly trace CEQA's impact on the lack of affordable and dense housing. So this was something that Lonsdale brought up really early in our conversation. And to me, it was immediately evocative of Austin's zoning and land use rewrite hurdles, which is something that I'm really fascinated by, because when I first moved to Austin, we were right in the thick of this dispute over Code Next. So basically, a little bit before I moved to Austin in 2012, city officials decided that the code that had served the city for 30 years was no longer useful. Basically, the city was growing super quickly, and it was very clear that prioritizing density would become necessary for the city to transition from a mid-sized entity to something a little larger. But demand for housing was really, really strong. The job market was rich, and so city officials decided that this was important to prioritize. Code Next, as it was written, was actually, I don't want to say it was like an urbanist dream, but it was pretty damn good, especially compared to what we often see. It aimed to really reduce separations between Austin's residential and commercial corridors. It allowed for a lot of mixed-use buildings. It allowed for just more housing and density overall. A lot of single-family zoning restrictions would have been scrapped. It would have allowed for triplexes and fourplexes and smaller apartment buildings, this sort of missing middle housing, as it's termed in urbanist communities, to be built instead of just single-family homes. It would have allowed an awful lot of urban infill instead of forcing newcomers to gravitate to the suburbs, which, by the way, when you gravitate to the suburbs, then you create more and more congestion on these big north-south corridors in Austin, like MoPac and I-35, that already have a crazy amount of traffic. So allowing more urban infill has a lot of perks for a lot of people. It wasn't exactly an urbanist dream, because I think some people really disliked that it didn't go far enough, but it was pretty good. It would have absolutely been a better situation than what we got. But ultimately, what happened was there was a lot of anti-developer fears. They were really stoked by campaigns against Code Next. And there were a lot of concerns bandied about neighborhood character. Everybody wants to get in and pull the ladder up after them, making sure their neighborhood never changes too much. But in reality, that dynamic has to be embraced, right? Like the dynamism has to be embraced, because that's what cities are all about. A stagnant city isn't a place that you want to live. So by 2018, the project was dead in the water.
These were families who were living in single family homes who were afraid of big high rise style developments, you know, coming in and splitting up their blocks, when in reality, even at its most permissive, Code Next was much more about maybe replacing some single family homes with, you know, a couple of duplexes with relatively small buildings, but that would have allowed more people to live on the same plots of land.
Exactly. And I mean, I live on the east side in a neighborhood called Holly. I live technically walking distance from downtown. If I want to brave the heat, I can walk for about 2 miles and get to downtown bar districts. So I'm in a really great place. I don't need to rely on a car. My husband and I have one car between the two of us, and we're getting rid of it soon. In general, I live in a super walkable neighborhood populated by craftsmen, bungalows. It's absolutely lovely. But when I look around, I don't think adding threeplexes and fourplexes would be something that really destroys the character of this area. And yet my neighborhood was one of the ones who met Code Next with the greatest, fiercest opposition, in part because homeowners had these really bloated property values and were worried about their property values going down, which, I mean, you and I are both big fans of property rights, right, Peter? Like, we're both homeowners. We both understand the incentives at play here. But it was still really frustrating the degree to which this plan for slightly more mixed use, slightly more density, was really met with this super fierce opposition and defeated quite quickly. It's honestly very sad. And I think some of it, when I was speaking with city council members who served during this time, they kept pointing to the fact that, like, the mayor and other members of city council just had this spinelessness about them. There was this cowardice and this unwillingness to communicate some of the benefits to density to rightfully concerned homeowners. So it was, to some degree, a political communication issue.
Yeah, we've had some of these same issues in Washington, D.C., even in my neighborhood, where there has, in fact, been a lot of development recently. And I think something that some of the homeowners who were maybe opposed to some of the development up front did not entirely understand or appreciate was that the developments a couple of blocks away would actually increase the value of some of the homes and actually be good for the homeowners. But so we've talked a bunch about San Francisco and Austin. I want to get to Miami here. Miami is interesting in particular because it has explicitly courted a reputation as an alternative to San Francisco. So tell me about that. Tell me about the ways that it has tried to lure San Francisco tech workers. And then I want you to just sort of think about, is there anything real there, or is it mostly just marketing? Like, what does Miami actually have to offer besides the fact that it's not San Francisco?
So Miami's mayor, who was recently elected, Francis Suarez, responded to a tweet by a VC, Dillian Asparahov, who tweeted kind of jokingly, all lowercase and sort of the manner that's very like stylistic, very stylish for tech dudes. Okay, guys, hear me out. What if we move Silicon Valley to Miami? And so Suarez responded immediately in December 2020, how can I help? And I think this is really emblematic of the whole vibe where Suarez is almost this extremely online. I don't want to say trollish because he's not trolling. He seems sincere. But he's somebody who doesn't actually have a lot of power. The Miami mayoral position is a part-time role. Suarez is pretty green, but he seems enthusiastic. He seems excited. He seems honestly kind of enchanted by the tech crowd and like he wants some attention from them and like he's willing to engage in whatever Twitter theatrics are needed in order to drum up some hype. Not that the hype wasn't there before. I think without Suarez, people would still sort of be attracted to Miami and to Florida in general. If you think about it, Florida is, I mean, you're from there. Florida is a no income tax state. So there's that value add in the same way that there is with Texas. There's already quite a few important, impressive VCs who migrated there. There's Keith Raboy. There's the cryptocurrency bull, Anthony Pompliano. There's the investor, Dan Sunheim, a whole bunch of private equity dudes, people who serve on the board of SpaceX and Tesla. There's a whole bunch of companies that have gravitated there, creating HQ2s or new presences. Plus, South Florida has a really impressive aerospace tech scene. So there's definitely, in both Texas and Florida, already these space innovation hubs. And so it's sort of a natural fit for people who are perhaps from San Francisco or from Southern California to want to migrate to these places. One thing that Dillian also noted when I interviewed him, he's sort of the center of the initial hype beast moment with Suarez. One thing he said to me, though, is I'd attribute it all to the Cubans fleeing Fidel Castro, having very similar values to hyper-capitalist technology investors, founders, and executives. That completely by chance overlap is like 95% of the reason why this is showing so much success. And by this, he was referring to, you know, the influx of California migrants to Miami. And I thought that was really interesting because obviously that's music to my libertarian anti-communist ears. But I think to some degree, this is correct as a hypothesis. It's not really necessarily the Suarez hype so much as it is. There is this already this really impressive super capitalist migrant culture in a lot of South Florida. And so to some degree, the politics of it are a natural fit for a lot of these capitalist tech dudes.
How much of this is about city culture? Right. I mean, so San Francisco has long had this kind of hippie alternative culture associated with it. It has courted that reputation, you know, as a place that is about free living and free thinking. Austin has, you know, everybody knows the Austin tagline, keep Austin weird, which was a big thing even in the 1990s. Right. The idea was that in the midst of a fairly culturally conservative Republican state, Austin was like an outpost of strange behavior where you could go and be yourself and do your own weird artsy thing. And Miami, you know, you talked about the entrepreneurial culture there. So how much of the draw away from San Francisco is the historic culture of these cities?
Are you asking whether it's about vibes, Peter?
Yes.
I mean, I think to some
degree... Isn't it always about vibes?
I think it is about vibes. I mean, I think to some degree, that's really true. People, so many longtime Austinites will talk about how Austin is no longer weird in any way. And although Austin has gotten sort of more buttoned up and embraced the airspace aesthetic, I don't know if you're familiar with that term, but it's the idea that you could go to a coffee shop in any hip, mid-sized American city, or even a whole bunch of cities of the world, and you kind of get the same thing every time. You get like a fiddly fig, and you get like white walls and certain like light fixtures, and it's like this carbon-copied aesthetic over and over. And so Austin, to some degree, has gotten more like that over time, I think to a fault. But there is still just like an innate weirdness, a freeness to how people live here and to people's attitudes. A lot of people in Austin, I know it's a big stereotype, but like the whole dazed and confused Matthew McConaughey type character, I know so many people like that who are just these like sort of lazy layabouts. Maybe they're not actively smoking a joint or a cigarette, but like that's sort of their vibe. They're probably going to do that at some point this, you know, today. And I mean, I walk downtown in Austin and there's a vagabond type character who keeps a pet chicken on his shoulder and feeds the chicken donuts as they walk
up. Okay, I'm moving there right now.
But Austin is weird like that. And then Miami, I mean, I remember after Matt Welch and Nancy Rallman and some of those folks came back from Miami, they just could not stop telling me about how the bikini cuts there were especially scandalous and people of all ages really embraced the whole almost like Brazilian beach vibe. You know, the nudity, the sexiness, the sort of over the top, this lack of inhibitions that I think is really foreign for people who have just spent time in really big coastal cities. So Miami and Austin, I think, both have a freeness to them. And I think that combined with the fact that it's a really favorable tax situation is naturally super appealing to these people.
I think there's a Will Smith joke there somehow. Welcome to Miami, right? Like, I'm not going to sing the song. So it does seem like this story, though, this is a story of three cities, but I think in a lot of ways it's bigger, especially in an era of remote work. So how do you see this sort of city-based competition playing out post-COVID as office workers find themselves no longer tethered to an office?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it'll be really interesting. Like, one point that was made to me as I interviewed people within Miami's scene is that tech recruiting there necessarily means importing people. There aren't amazing engineering schools. There aren't these feeder schools for coders in the same way you had Stanford for many years, in the same way that, honestly, Boston's venture capital scene was pretty vibrant because of these feeder schools, because of MIT and Harvard being nearby. To some degree, Austin gets to reap those rewards because of UT Austin actually being a pretty excellent school. But I thought it was interesting, this idea that tech recruiting in Miami necessarily means importing talent. I think one person, a Florida expat, told a reporter for The Intelligencer, it's hard to find a company that grew to be worth more than $100 billion that wasn't started within a bike ride of a world-class engineering department, which I think is a really pithy quote that sort of describes the problem here, where there's not necessarily a natural core, an incubator space for all this tech talent. And so I think that's something that might ultimately hinder some of South Florida's development. So in some ways, San Francisco does remain this really strong driver of innovation. There's a lot of deep tech stuff. There's a lot of open source work that's happening there. There's evolution in biology. There's a whole bunch of ways that the tech scenes in these different places might become really differentiated going forward. So I think personally that South Florida may serve as this really innovative space for aerospace and for crypto, which is something we're seeing a lot of. But Austin will remain really strong for engineering and software sales talent. Plus, there's sort of the emerging Elon Musk-led SpaceX scene on the city's outskirts. So I think it'll be kind of interesting. We'll see them being bifurcated more and more, where people who want to work in a specific sector will decide where to live based off of that. But you bring up such a good point, which is that it's not just Miami and Austin competing with California. They're competing with each other, and they're competing with every single other small to mid-sized city. So there's lots of places a promising young engineer could choose to live and work from. And I think it's a really open, unsettled question. This is something that Derek Thompson at The Atlantic has been thinking a lot about. A lot of the writers at Bloomberg have been mulling this question. Like, what's the future of agglomeration effects? What does that look like? So agglomeration effects are the sort of clustering of industry that leads to better job matching and boosted productivity. You know, think about it. The reason why I like to live in Austin or New York City is because there's other people similar to me who live in these places. This makes it a more attractive proposition than living in Pittsburgh or the outskirts of Pittsburgh or whatever. You know, in New York, I can go hang out with other journalists who like the same music and food as me, and same in Austin. And so there's like a personal agglomeration effects thing, but there's also a career value add to being in a city where there's other people who are doing cool and innovative things that you will necessarily be exposed to. But I think it's really interesting because it's an open question as to how much agglomeration effects still matter and what the post-pandemic era really looks like for job seekers and what they'll prioritize. Maybe going to parties that service informal networking opportunities will be less valuable to people than living in a lower cost of living place. I just don't know what that looks like. Do you have any theories?
Well, I guess I was just gonna ask you at the very end to reflect on this, since it's so personal for you at this very moment. I know you mentioned New York already, and you have been kind of splitting your time between Austin and New York, but you are currently in the process of moving from Austin back to New York. And I guess I just want to end by asking, why New York? New York is not a cheap place to live. The taxes are not low. Tell me why you're moving back there, and we'll end there.
I think New York is the most libertarian city in America, which I know is something that gets me a lot of hate. Okay,
tell me why New York is the most libertarian city in America, and then we're going to go.
Yeah, New York's the most libertarian city in America because it is a place of both an emphasis on order and laws, but also this lawlessness that just constantly flouts this attempt at establishing order. New York is a place where anything goes. New York is a place where there's rules that govern what you can and cannot bring on the subway. And guess what? Nobody adheres to them, ever. New York is a place where immigrants come to it and manage to, in some cases, flout licensing restrictions and zoning restrictions and build new businesses out of nothing. And whether it's the little old lady from Central America selling mango slices on the subway platform and ultimately sometimes getting hassled by NYPD for doing so, for her gall, you know, this is the American dream. It's such a pure distillation of it. The fact that you have this spontaneous order that you're constantly seeing, all of these people, you know, 8.5 million people who are managing to peacefully, not always peacefully, mostly peacefully coexist near each other, all pursuing the things that they love and value, and oftentimes pursuing profit, rubbing shoulders with each other and managing to, by and large, keep to themselves and go about pursuing their dreams, I think it's really incredible. I sort of wonder how many remittances are sent from New York, this hub of economic opportunity, back to, you know, third world countries, developing countries. I wonder to what degree New York is this generator of wealth for that people are able to tap into in all kinds of countries where one of their family members has immigrated to New York and managed to make something of themselves, and now the family's supported back home by it. So I see New York as this land of lawlessness. I see it as this land where immigrants can and do consistently pursue the things they value. And I see it as a place where, frankly, even the richest of people and the poorest of people are to some degree able to have this shared sense of New Yorkerness. You know, they all go to bodegas. They all take advantage of the public parks like Central Park, which, yes, I guess having public parks isn't really a super libertarian thing. The fact that it's flat subway fare, although I would prefer for the subway system to be prioritized, I do think experimenting with it being flat fare allows people from even really, really far outer boroughs to access economic opportunity deep within the heart of Manhattan. And they're paying for it in time, but they're not paying for it in money the same way. So I see New York as this glorious experiment in dynamism and spontaneous order, and a really, really great example of how freaking awesome immigrants are. They make a lot of our lives better. And I think more and more cities should have this vibrance that New York does.
So New York is the total opposite of rule-following Washington, D.C., where I live. It's a D.C. is a city where everyone loves rules and lives to make and enforce them. Everyone except our friends at Reason Magazine. Liz Wolf, thank you so much for joining me. That's all the time we have this week. To listeners, if you like this show, please remember to subscribe and recommend it to friends. As always, if you like this podcast or Reason's work generally, you can support us at reason.com/donate. That's reason.com/donate. I'm Peter Suderman, and this has been the Reason Rundown.